which would have been,
how do you get the gig with Lester Flatt?
At the end of the weekend, he offered me a job.
How do you have the ability to do things like that?
Well, maybe that's where show business comes in handy.
What's the best Johnny Cash guitar part? Who is the most influential guitar player in the history of country music? Marty, how did you get Clarence Voigt's guitar? Like right there, you go up the neck, you play a little lick. How do you know what that lick is?
I don't know.
This episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered.
Marty Stewart on the podcast.
Dude,
thanks for taking the time. How did we get so lucky? How did we pull this off?
Well, you know what? This reminds me of like going to the candy store, right?
Yeah.
Christmas.
We're at the Fender showroom.
We're at the Fender showroom in Nashville. And I go back to when I was a kid, I dreamed of having a Fender guitar. And I saw all my favorite guitar heroes playing Telecasters on television. And there was one place in my hometown that had musical instruments. It was the hardware store. And they carried some like off-brand kind of guitars, but it didn't matter to me because there was guitars and violins and mandolins hanging around, one mandolin. And I used to go up there after school and just dream about playing guitar. And when I got my first Fender guitar, it was like the world had come to an end. I loved it.
What was your first Fender guitar?
It was a red Fender Mustang. It was so cool.
How much of an influence did Don Rich have on your playing? Because I said, what do you want? You could pick anything. And you said, give me the Don Rich guitar.
Well, the first song I ever learned to play, I started my first band when I was 9. And the first song that I ever learned to play was Tiger by the Tail. So if you know, I'm a kid of the 60s, right? And so if you were anywhere on the planet on the 60s and came within a mile of country radio, Buck Owens and the Buckaroos were in your room or in your car or wherever they had a speaker because they were so popular. And their music, when it comes on the radio today, it still sounds just as fresh and powerful.
Doesn't
to me
it sound
as
it incredible? Did.
Oh, it's great. It's
unbelievable.
Great. Timeless.
So you heard Don Rich, the Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, and you said, I got to learn how to play Tiger by a Tail. So how'd you learn how to play it in your band?
My buddy Butch Hodgins, his mom.
Yeah.
Butch was my best pal. He and his brother, Ricky, and I had our little band, our little neighborhood band. His mom showed me the first three chords, Tiger by the Tail.
Which are what? What are the first?
G, C, and D. It's
that's like, it. You could play Tiger by the Tail with that. So that was the first thing you learned how to play on guitar?
It was.
Was Buck Owens.
Was Tiger by the Tail.
Tiger by the Tail. And what were you just playing the Buck Owens acoustic guitar part? That's what you learned,
pretty
basically.
Much. Just chords on electric guitar.
So at what point did you go, I need to learn how to do the leads? And then when did you figure out what Don Rich was doing?
Well, it wasn't Don so much. The next thing I heard that got my ear and changed my life was...
Which would have been Johnny Cash, Luther Perkins.
Luther. And, you know...
Folsom Prison Blues.
And Kenny Vaughan and I talk about this.
Yeah, what do you talk to Kenny Vaughan about?
Well, we talk guitars. And Kenny said Folsom was one of the very first pieces that he ever learned to play. And people would come to his house just to watch him play the solo. It was a thing to play that solo.
They would go to Kenny's house to watch Kenny play the solo.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically, you go, I got to learn this. So you're listening to Folsom Prison Blues. And was it hard to pick out that solo? Or did all this come really easy to you?
Well, it was pretty natural. And they were on television a lot, so I'd watch Luther Perkins' fingers and try to figure out things. And I got within, I got close. Nobody can play it exactly like Luther. But Chris Scruggs and I were talking about this the other day. His son Ben just turned 11 years old, and he is completely consumed with the music that came from Sun Studios in Memphis. And we talk about, especially like the Johnny Cash music, those guys could barely change chords together. It was so elementary, so raw, so rudimentary, but at the same time, it had an importance about it that transcends generations. And now here's Ben Scruggs playing the same stuff that we played as kids. I love that about that music.
So I'm trying to figure this out, though. So you're in a garage band playing Buck Owens. How did you really develop your talent, though, especially on the mandolin when you started going out with... How did you figure this out? I just don't get it.
The first part of the story was everybody in my hometown, our regional local bands, were pretty much bands that honored the British invasion,
okay.
Rock and roll guys. I loved country music
you,
as a child.
Yeah.
And I wanted me and my band to be correspondents for our heroes in the backwoods of Mississippi. And one thing led to another, and I started out as an electric guitar player. And when I was 12, I fell in love with the mandolin again, and my electric guitar went under the stereo for a long time, and the mandolin became my primary instrument until I could learn to play it.
Because you like the Leuven Brothers, or why were you so into the mandolin? It was Bill Monroe.
Bill Monroe. I bought a 78 scratchy record, 78 RPM scratchy record. It was The Wicked Path of Sin. And I believe the little community church was on the other side. And I kept playing that record over and over. I just loved the feeling that it gave me in my heart.
So would you play a record and you would find note by note on the mandolin what you were doing, and that's how you learned how to play the instrument? Is that
it? Yes, I could. And again, Bill Monroe's playing some of those songs. They appeared very simple. They're very complex. But there was one called Will You Be Loving Another Man? And I tried and I tried and I tried to get it down on the mandolin, and it never would come. And I promise you, I kicked it under my bed. My mom took me and my sister to church that night. On the way home from church, I thought, I'm going to play that mandolin one more time. And when I came home, I took it out and I could play along with the record somehow. It was very simple, but it got me started.
Marty, how are you so confident that you were going to make it?
I watched My Heroes on Saturday afternoon on television. That's where Porter Wagoner and the Wilburn Brothers and Johnny Cash and Flatten Scruggs and Del Reeves and a lot of other artists in this town had syndicated television shows that played in our region. I'd listen to the music during the week on the radio, but then I'd see them on the weekends, and they wore these fancy cowboy clothes that twinkled and played cool guitars. And I just knew that I wanted to be a part of that world. And maybe once or twice a year, some of these guys from Nashville would come to my hometown and play, and it was like correspondence again, there's that word, from another world that I wanted to be a part of. It was a magical land to me.
Marty, I've heard this story that when you were a kid, didn't Martin Luther Jr. march through, and didn't your parents take you to watch this happen, and didn't you see him marching through Philadelphia, Mississippi?
I did. Martin Luther King made a speech on the lawn of the courthouse, at the steps of the courthouse. And for a figure of his stature to come through that town during that such a volatile time where there was so much animosity and hate and anger in the air, it was a big move. And people were nervous because churches were being blown up. People took guns and knives and bats everywhere they went. Nobody knew where the next problem was going to come from. But my dad took my sister Jennifer and I. We went to this park close to the square, I think it was, and he stood us on the front bumper of his truck, and we watched Dr. King walk down the street. And I didn't quite know what I was seeing or who I was seeing, but I had heard the name and I knew that something big was going on. That's the feeling I took away.
Did that, to me, it's almost amazing that your parents exposed you to that, or was that instantly in that moment, did that kind of show you what was right or wrong or what to believe in or not to believe in? Was that a pivotal moment?
Well, you couldn't live down there without being exposed to all of that chaos. But my mother was one of those people, she lived and taught love to every human being. You love people as best you can. And that was the deal, is you try to love people. And that's Hilda Stewart's teaching. And so, but I had no problem with anybody down there, because as a child, there was a cafe in that town called the Busy Bee Cafe.
The Busy Bee Cafe.
And it was a black juke joint, shoeshine parlor, part restaurant, honky-tonk. And it was on the street. And it was two doors down from the place that I went and stayed after I got out of kindergarten, till my mom got there. And white people were not encouraged to go there, but I was really little and I loved dancing. And I'd go and just start dancing, and everybody in there just laughed and was glad to see me coming, and I loved them. They were colorful characters. They wore flashy clothes, crazy hair. Everybody was about being their own personality. And the sound and the beat of the music was so much different than country music, but I loved it. But it taught me that love and respect and music can get you through a lot of doors.
That's what that taught you. Okay, so you're growing up in Philadelphia, Mississippi. You're playing the mandolin. Your teacher kicks you out of the class, in ninth grade. And you go, I got to get a gig. The teacher kicked you out of the class because you were reading country music publications over your history book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says to you, you say to him, "I'd rather make history than learn about history."
Mrs. Gordon.
So he kicks you out of the class, and then how do you get the gig with Lester Flatt? You end up on his bus. How do you convince him to take you on the road at 13?
I'd been on the road at 12 with at the 12. Sullivan Family Gospel Bluegrass Singers, and we played camp meeting revivals and bluegrass festivals and those kind of shows. And one of the guys in Lester's band was named Roland White, the mandolin player.
And the brother of Clarence White.
Brother Clarence White. And Roland was a really friendly person. He specialized in kind of showing young musicians the ropes, and he had very patient. So we got along really famously when I met him, asking for his autograph, and I asked him for his pick. And he gave me one of his ties and his phone number. And he said, "Well, maybe sometimes... You know, I can ask Lester and you can ride with us for a weekend." So when the Sullivan family dropped me back off to go to school, I was a pitiful excuse for a student. I had my heart and my soul had been on the road and I had seen the other side, and I wanted no part of school. So I got kicked out of school, like you said. Mrs. Gordon was my teacher. And I went home and called Roland and I said, "This would be a good time to come to Nashville." And then, of course, the way I presented it to my mom and dad was, "You'll never guess who called. Lester Flatt wants me to come."
That's what. So you call him, and yeah. Then you go tell your parents he called you.
Yeah.
Which is genius, well, right? How'd you know how to do that?
Because
you just
I practiced that for years with me and Butch hanging out. Butch wants me to spend the night tonight. We can camp out, you know. And of course, mother saw through every bit of that. But this one was more serious, and I think she understood the weight of the matter. So it was finally agreed after a lot of begging and pleading. One weekend, and when I got to Nashville, bus station was right over there on Broadway, right across from Broadway. And 2 days later, I was on the bus and met Lester, and he heard me and Roland in the back play, and he says, "Why don't you do that on the show this weekend, 4 shows?" And at the end of the weekend, he offered me a job, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing, but I felt like that might happen the first night I got to this town, because I just felt like I belonged here.
You have to have some insight looking back, and you must see kids all the time playing music. He could have written you off. He could have been so generous and still have written you off. He didn't have to offer you a job. Why did he bring you on the road?
I do not know. The only answer I have for you is he possibly saw something inside of me that I had no idea was there. He was a wise old architect and a great pioneer. And I think he probably saw something in my heart that I hope I've come close to living up to. And that's the only answer I have.
You don't think you were a special player at 13, or you don't think it was anything to do with that?
I was okay. But I mean, I hear players now that at that age that play rings around me. But there was something in my heart that he understood. And I played okay. I got by and I learned quick.
Do you think he thought you brought good charisma to the band, or that was it?
And I also think that he and Earl Scruggs had broken up two or three years previous to that. Earl took off with his sons, and they were, you know, teenagers, and started playing college campuses and rock and roll shows. And Lester was still playing with the old guys, and I think he saw a spark of youth in me that might not hurt his show. And I think he understood that I was born to be on a bus and be a part of show business. Again, I see it in Chris Scruggs' son, Ben, now, he comes on the road with us and went, "You'll never make it to the eighth grade." It takes one to know one.
I've heard this story that you got offered a gig, I think, to play for Glenn Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And you said to Lester, you said, "I think I'm going to take this gig." And he said, "You're not ready."
It was all I could do. My buddy Carl Jackson, who we worked together with the Sullivan family, he worked with Glenn Campbell while I was working with Lester. And Lester was aging, and he was not feeling well anymore, and shows were starting to cancel here and there. And I didn't know how much future was left with that band. And I was young and full of myself and ready to go. I thought I was ready to go. And I called him to the back of the bus one day, and I said, "Lester, Glenn Campbell has offered me a job." And he put his head on the bunk, and he took a minute, and he came back. He says, "You're just not ready yet." And I knew he was right.
No, why were you not ready, though?
Because
wouldn't you have
knew,
learned on the job? I don't understand.
Well, I knew that it was the wrong thing to leave him first at that moment, because he had taken me in when I was a kid. So there was some loyalty involved. And I just knew that I moved and went over with Glenn Clement. I'd probably have to live in Los Angeles. I was a teenager. I wasn't equipped for that, and I think I knew it.
You knew it. So he says to you, you're not ready, and that didn't trigger you to go, what do you mean, of course I'm ready?
No.
You really knew, you said.
Because I respected everything about his word. I respected everything that he helped invent what I was doing. Again, one of the pioneer master architects of the country music world. So, and I came from those kind of people. They were wisdom-based people, not highly educated formally, but they were probably smarter than everybody else that went to college put together. Lester had a third-grade education, and to this day still stands as one of the wisest men I've ever known. And I knew in my heart that he was telling me the truth.
Do you ever just think how incredible it is that you were able to reunite Earl and Lester, and you were really able to convince Earl to go visit Lester when he was dying because you had an interaction with Bob Dylan, right?
Yeah.
And he tells you, he doesn't even tell you to do anything. He just says, oh man, it'd be great if they could get together.
He asked me if Lester and Earl ever talked anymore. I said, nah, they're always going to, but they never quite get around to it. And Bob just simply said, eh, it's kind of a shame because Abbott and Costello, the old comedy team, said the fat guy and the other guy never got back together, but they were always going to. When he said that, there was like this bag of stones hit my heart, and I didn't know Earl. I left Bob's concert, went to a phone booth, and got Earl's phone number and called. Said, I'm Marty Stewart. I played with Lester. And Earl said, I know who you are. He said, I like your play. And I went, I like yours too. And I said, can I come visit you? It's really important now. And so he said, sure, come on out. And so I went to Earl's house in Madison. He and his wife Louise were sitting there. And I said, Lester's dying. He's not going to make it out of the hospital this time. And I know he loves you, because they were not on friendly terms. I said, I know he loves you. You are brothers. And I said, I don't think he'd like to die without saying bye to you. And I said, I'll do anything I can to help you say bye to him, if you could go by and see him. And Earl said, I'll have to think about it. And unannounced, he just showed up and went and sat by Lester's bed and said goodbye.
How do you have the wisdom to do these things? I think about so many times in my life that I've let moments pass by, or I go, oh, that would be great if they got together, but I would feel like it wouldn't be my responsibility to make that happen. How do you have the insight, or how do you have the ability to do things like that?
They meant so much to me. Their music did. Flat and Scruggs and Johnny Cash were the first two records I ever owned, and they meant a lot to me back in those civil rights times. Their music, they were family to me. I felt like I was a part of their family. When I'd watch their television shows as a kid, I'd go, man, wouldn't it be great if I was one of their kids and could carry their instrument cases to the bus or something. I mean, I dreamed about that stuff. And just because they weren't together, I'd known people that had got a divorce before, and you never take sides. You just love everybody. And it was important to me. I saw the moment. I felt it in my heart. And you would have done the same thing.
I don't know. Here's what I think. I think I might have felt like it might not have been my responsibility, or it might not have been my place to overstep. That might be how I felt. I wish, right? Or no?
Well, I think the circumstances would have dictated it to your heart. And I think you would have followed your heart. I had no choice. If I wanted to live with myself and not go, oh, if I'd only done that for the rest of my life, I had to follow my heart. And I was shaking like a leaf when I went out there, because it was not a warm and friendly room. They were looking at me like, what do you want? What are you
right.
here for? It was ice cold.
I might not have felt welcome in that room. And I'd be thinking, I'm not welcome in this room. It's not my place. I'm not going to go do that.
Well, maybe that's where show business comes in handy, because sometimes, how many times have you walked on stage and you didn't exactly feel welcome, and you had to sell it, and by the time you leave, the job was, okay, now we're friends.
Who is the character of Marty Stewart? You have to have invented this character in the third grade, practicing your autograph. There's something to this, right? What is it?
It speaks for itself.
It speaks for itself, right?
It's a comedy
but
routine.
But you just said, so you go on stage, and you might feel one way, and you come off stage feeling something else, so you have to tap into something, some energy. And I look at you, you're a country icon. But how did you develop that?
I watched people that had an image when I was falling in love with music. Elvis Presley, Little Richard, the guy on the $20 bill, Einstein, Johnny Cash, the Beatles, the Monkees, Bob Dylan, keep going, Rolling Stones. Those guys were characters, and it all goes back to the characters that hung out at the Busy Bee Cafe. They just looked like an extension of those cats,
yeah,
to me. And they looked like they were one-of-a-kind people who lived by their own rules and their own heart, and the rest of the world could go do what it wanted to do. But that's kind of what I come from, and I feel best when it's nothing like it when you're doing your own thing and the rest of the world's in on it going, that's pretty good. I'm going, I know, come on. But even when it's cold and nobody's listening or looking, to be true to yourself, you still have to do that.
So if you're on a Sunday, what do you get dressed? Are you ever in shorts and a t-shirt? On
yeah,
a, yeah.
Of course. This is work clothes.
This is work clothes. So if I come over for breakfast,
I can loan you some.
I'll take them. What do you got for me?
What size are you, pal?
I'm a medium. Okay? That's what do we have?
That's what we said the other day. Chris Skrug says when he joined the band, says, Marty, we need a bass player. So what size are you?
Because you got, who makes your suits? Is it Jaime in North Hollywood?
Jaime in North Hollywood, Manuel. We still wear the band, we still wear old nudie costumes from time to time if we can find them. I love cowboy couture.
I thought about wearing a Manuel jacket today that I have, but I didn't want to. I thought it looked silly, you know?
Oh, no way.
I blew it.
I was in Manuel's store one day, and this lady was trying on this, I mean, just blinged out thing. She says, but where would I wear it? He says, anywhere you want to.
That's it?
That's it.
Okay. After Lester Flatt, you go and you play for Johnny Cash. Mm. I am blown away by this story that you show up at this first gig. You don't know what the cellist is. You don't know anything. You show up in the hotel lobby and he calls you and he says, do you know my songs? And you basically say, yeah, I think so. And you just hit it that night. How did you know all of the songs? Because you've been listening to them your whole life?
Sure. Like first
album
records,
was Folsom Prison Blues.
And I followed him ever since. He was my old country music hero. And after Lester passed away, I needed a job. And all the bluegrass bands around the Grand Ole Opry, the Jim and Jesse, Bill Monroe, the Osborne Brothers, away from the Opry, Ralph Stanley, Jimmy Martin, everybody had their bands were full. They didn't need me. So I started looking for work. Found a little bit of work with Vassar Clements and Doc and Merle Watson for a few months. But a buddy of mine named Danny Farrington was building a black guitar that was kind of flashy, and I went in to take my guitar to be repaired up here on Second Avenue. I said, whose guitar? Johnny Cash. I'm building this guitar for Johnny Cash. I said, I want to go when you deliver it. I want to meet this thing. I want to meet him. He's my hero. And so I knew he'd forget it, but I kept up with it.
See, that's another moment, Marty, where I don't know if I met someone and they said they were building Johnny Cash's guitar, I don't know that I would say, take me with you when you deliver it to him. Isn't that a ballsy thing to say?
I reckon I needed a job.
You needed a job. Okay, so you say, take me with you when you deliver the guitar.
And so I went with him to Cowboy Jack Clement's studio. I met John and Cowboy Jack Clement at the same time, two of my lifelong friends. And John stood up to shake my hand. I said, I'm Marty. He said, I know who you are. He said, where are you from? I went, Mississippi. He just kept shaking my hand. It was like lightning. Blah, 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 blah. And I said, oh. He said, where are you from? I went, Mississippi. He said, where you been, son? I went, getting ready. He said, well, let's go. And we had a great evening of just hanging out, playing music, talking songs. And I went back to work with Doc and Merle Watson, had a handful of shows left. And on the last day, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I went back to the hotel. My phone light used to blink on the phone. My mom, she said, call Bob Wooten, Johnny Cash's guitar player. He's looking for you. So I called. I said, hi, Bob. He said, John wants to know if you want to go to work with us. I went, not a bad idea. I said, when? He said, how about tomorrow? I said, where are you? They were in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. They were in Des Moines, Iowa, and I was in Cedar Rapids.
Right.
So it was a two-hour car ride and kind of meant to be, wasn't it?
So you just show up on that first gig, and what was your role? You were playing mandolin or you were playing guitar?
I was told to bring everything I had, which was a mandolin and a fiddle and an acoustic guitar at that time, I think.
And you show up, and wasn't he playing with a really big band at that point?
He had a band called the Great 80s Eight. It had trumpets, and it had a piano. Earl Ball played piano and synthesizer, two electric guitars, bass, and drums.
Okay, so you show up in this massive band. You've never rehearsed. How do you know what to play, or do you naturally just know what to play?
I basically let the song start, and I followed. But But that one was easy because you just lay out.
Yeah.
Stay
what do you
out
mean
of the
lay
way.
Out? You just
stay
played
out
it.
Of the way. Well, Bob Wooten played that part.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I wasn't
yeah.
needed. I just sat back there and went.
That's what you play. A little bit of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of texture.
So I spent my first at least couple of 3 months just looking for a place to fit in that band because they didn't need me. I think John just wanted to have me around.
What were some other parts from that gig? Do you remember anything else that you played on that first night?
Well, Folsom Prison Blues, Sunday Morning Coming Down, Orange Blossom Special, The Ballad of Ira Hayes. Those are the ones that kind of come to mind.
What's the best Johnny Cash guitar part?
His rhythm playing.
It's his. How do you play the rhythm? Like,
well, Cowboy Jack Clement called it the magic thumb. John, he could set the rhythm with the band, but when he was really special to me. I live in the cemetery. Old caretaker, they call me. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Who's gonna cry when old John dies? Who's gonna cry when old John dies? He just had that way of accompanying himself with his thumb.
Like that Carter
It
thing.
Was so beautiful.
That's the takeaway. Is that what we should all be taking away from his guitar playing?
Well, he also could, you know... could do that. He was Johnny Cash's best guitar player.
Didn't he get you your record label,
mm-hmm.
your record deal?
Mm-hmm.
Because you pulled in, why didn't you pull in the Highwaymen, that song? You found that song.
We were in Montrose, Switzerland. He was doing Christmas specials and spring specials for networks back there, CBS network, I think. And there was a Christmas special filmed in Montrose, Switzerland. And the guests were Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, and Kris Kristofferson. And part of the entourage was a fellow named Chips Moman, who was producing records on Waylon, or Willie, I think. And at that point, Willie was recording lots of duet records. And the Christmas special was so-so. It's on YouTube, you can see it. But the magic was, after the concert, everybody would wind up in John and June's suite, passing the guitar around, those guys. And oddly enough, John and Willie were not close friends, and they started becoming fast pals. And so Chips Moman suggested, well, when we get back to Nashville, you and Willie need to do a record. Yeah, let's do it. So we came back, and that happened. But about 2 days in, nothing had happened because their voices were so different. Yeah. And I thought, what we need here is the feeling that was in that room when the four of those guys were laughing and ragging on each other and singing songs together. And my cousin Marty Gamblin ran Glenn Campbell's publishing company. And Carl Jackson, my old buddy, had always told me about a song that Glenn recorded that Jimmy Webb wrote called The Highwayman. I love the title. I never heard it. So I called cousin Marty and said, do you have a song in your catalog called The Highwayman? Yeah. I said, could you make me a tape of it? So I went and picked it up on a break from the session. I heard it one time. I thought, four verses, no harmony required.
Perfect.
Perfect. And so I took it back to the studio, and the first two people I saw was Chips Moman and John. I said, listen to this, guys. And they played it once, and Chips played it for the second time. And I could see John's wheels turning, and he said, I want that verse about the starship. I went, you want to come in last. Is what
the
you
last
wanted.
Verse,
yeah.
right?
The
he
big
knew.
Verse. Yeah, of course.
Wait, so what did the demo sound like? So was the demo...
Well, it wasn't a demo.
It wasn't even a demo.
It was Glenn Campbell's record. Glenn had recorded the song. And it was a Glenn Campbell record. It was great.
So you listen to this Glenn Campbell recording, you go, that's going to be perfect. I got to get all four of these guys on it. There's four verses. So you bring it in, they record the song.
Well, I brought the song, and John and Willie were already there, and it was suggested, call Chris and Waylon, and somebody got on the phone, and the next thing you know, Chris came by to do his part somehow, and then Waylon did his part. Glenn Campbell was actually in town. I sang the scratch vocal, which was awful, but when Glenn came by, he actually put a vocal down that they could all actually follow, and that's how the Highwayman was found for those guys.
Do you just think it's unbelievable that you were at so many of these moments in country music, that you were in the room that you found that song? That's such an incredible song, isn't it? That recording of it, too.
Stick around long enough, some things happen.
So then why does Johnny Cash go, does he say you need to be a solo artist? And he calls a label for you?
He had been through this before with Larry Gatlin. Had come and gone through his show, the Oak Ridge Boys, Rodney Crowell, Roseanne. There had been a lot of kids come through there that used the Johnny Cash show as a learning ground, a stepping stone, and then on into their own thing. And he knew I had that in my heart. And when I brought that, people started saying, where did this song come from? Well, he brought it. Oh. And next thing I know, John said, make you a tape. I'll see what I can't do to help you. So it was nice to have him in my corner when it was time to go.
But just because you found a good song, he thought that would make for a good artist? Or he thought you could maybe pick good songs?
I think he knew that I had it. He knew that I had something that I could build on. Wasn't there yet, but I think he knew that there was enough talent there to build on.
I feel like so many artists today, they start being front and center so quick. And you seem to have had this reservation or this ability to say, I'm not ready. But to me, I would be thinking, I'm ready. Put me in the spotlight. Let's go. I'm not going to join Johnny Cash's band. I'm going to go be a solo artist. Why did that not occur to you, or did you not feel like you were ready?
I was trying. I'd made a record called Busy Bee Cafe that preceded my Columbia deal. But it goes back to the oldest thing in the book. Preparation is the greatest thing you could ever ask for. The Native American Society. Think about it. Start out as a scout, a water boy, brave, warrior, work your way up. And maybe if you're meant to be a chief, someday you will be a chief. And think of the things you learn along the way. There are no holes when you get there if you've done it right. And I felt like my career, still feel like my life has been a lot of it. It's always in stages and colors and seasons and learning.
Marty, how did you get Clarence White's guitar?
Clarence got killed in 1973. Drunk driver ran over him when he was loading his guitar into his car after he and Roland had kind of gone to a honky-tonk to sit in Southern California, in the valley in California. And his wife, Susie, had the guitar, and she moved back to Kentucky, where she was from, in the late 70s, 79 or 80, somewhere in there. And she started coming back to Nashville and visiting with Roland and bringing the kids, Bradley and Michelle. And they were just kind of like family to me, because Roland and his family, I lived with them till my mom and dad and sister moved up here. So that family was family. So here comes Susie home after 7 years of being alone out there. So we became pals and just family. And one night she called me and said, I need to sell some things. Okay. And I want to sell some of Clarence's things. Okay. I have a 54 Stratocaster, some Birds paraphernalia, a couple of his costumes, passport, blah, blah, blah. I said, Susie, whatever you want to sell is fine with me. So I put Roland's son, Lawrence, in the car with me. We drove to Kentucky. And while I was there, I said, Susie, that's fine. Whatever, it's fine. And I said, is Clarence's B-string bender here? She said, yeah, that's the one you want to see it. And I went, well, I'd love to see it. It was in the attic. It was missing a string in a Bird's road case. She popped the lid open. I went, whoa, there it is. Phew. And I picked it up, and I couldn't believe I was holding it. And I said, would you mind if I took a picture of it? She said, of course. She said, that's the one you really wanted. And I went, what are you talking about? She said, that guitar. I went, well, who wouldn't want this guitar, but nobody deserves to have it. She said, I'll think about it. So about dinner time that night, she said, I thought about this, and I'd like for you to have that guitar. I said, you're kidding. She said, no. And I'd just gone to work with Johnny Cash. I was making a little bit of regular dough. And I laid my checkbook on the kitchen table. I said, whatever, within reason, whatever you need, fill in the number. If I don't have it, my mom works at a bank. It'll be there in the morning. And I had told my mom that before I left town. And she's filled in $1,450 for everything. I went, Susie, you've made a big mistake. I said, the E string on this guitar is worth that. She says, I know what the guitar is worth, but you need to have that guitar. It's your responsibility. I went, So that's how the guitar came to me.
Why did she feel that way? That's the greatest thing ever, right?
I think she knew that I would care for it, and it has been one of my best pals since that day.
What is the Bender in that guitar like compared to maybe like a modern Glazer Bender?
I think it's Gene Parsons pretty much did that Bender, and it feels more like a steel guitar to me than Joe's Glazers are short and more concise. But there's a travel in there that has just more of a puts you into another universe. And that guitar sounds, you can put 10,000 guitars in a room and that one sounds like nobody else's. It's just a thing unto itself. And I love that guitar. I dearly love the sound of that guitar. And just when I think I've learned something, I listen to some old tapes, board tapes of the Birds or some old recording, like Back to the Woodshed. Clarence had it.
Oh, sorry. How much do you try to emulate what he was doing with that guitar, or do you just try to do your own thing with it?
You can't not run into Clarence. The greatest compliment is when we did the Sweetheart of the Rodeo tour with Roger McGuinn, Chris Hillman, and the Superlatives, the 50th anniversary, I had to woodshed and come up with as close as I could get to Clarence, which was close, but it was not there, to evoke the spirit of what he played, to honor those songs. And I got to be a Bird, and I kind of understood. We loved that tour. The band and I loved that tour. But nobody can duplicate Clarence. It's like duplicating Jimi Hendrix or Charlie Christian or any of those cats. He was a once-in-a-lifetime character.
You ever use the banjo tuners on that guitar
Not
for anything
much.
Specific?
Not much. I used to. The strings I play are much heavier than what Clarence used, and he could just flip them down, but I have to tune when I do it. But he played a song called Nashville West, and I think Mr. Spaceman, he used that open tuning. Nashville West was a song I tried and I tried and I tried and I never got it. So I wrote one called Hummingbird, BYRD, that was close to that I could actually sort of play Nashville West.
So when you play the guitar, Marty, you are a ferocious guitar player. It is mind-blowing to watch you play guitar. What do you think about when you look down at the fretboard, if you're playing in the key of A, do you see, I don't want to get too technical, but do you see pentatonic boxes? Do you see triads? How do you know what to play when? What do you see?
I have no idea.
But come on.
I cannot give you an answer because I cannot explain. It just comes out of my hands. And I wish I could say, well, Chris Scruggs is great. Or Kenny Vaughn can sit there and tell you, well, you take this and then, you know, raise this. And I have that vocabulary doesn't exist in my mouth. I pick it up. I loved what I heard Jerry Lee Lewis say one time about when he was learning to play the piano. He said, my hands just knew what to do. And I kind of felt like that was the same with me and a guitar. They were just supposed to do that.
But I see you get chord changes. I see you move around. So your ear just knows where to go. You have to have some frame of reference on the guitar, right? Or you have no idea.
Well, the Bender puts it into a different room. And into a different way of thinking. And it's basically, I wish I was a steel guitar player.
Yeah.
Which I can't play one lick on the steel. And I wish I could. But it's basically steel guitar thinking. And if when I think about it, there's Ralph Mooney and Clarence and Roy Nichols and Buck Owens, Don Rich and Muddy Waters and Hubert Sumlin that played with Howlin' Wolf. And that's kind of the guys I look and go, is this any good or not?
Wait, but I say we're going to play a song in the key of A. Your hand has to go somewhere. And then I say, take a solo. Is your ear going to tell you where to go up the fretboard? Or do you have licks that you know are in the key of A? Or how do you figure out what to play?
Why don't you just sing and I'll play with you, all right?
I can't sing. I'm not a singer. You're the singer. But I'm just trying to figure out how you visualize the guitar.
It just happens. It's just a natural reflex, I think. And plus 50-something years worth of experience playing guitar. I've been through a few songs, so I understand. It's most importantly to understand what don't work or what to leave out.
Yeah.
And air and space and laying out sometimes the greatest thing you could ever play.
So you get this Bender guitar and you go, I need to figure out what to do with this thing. I need to figure out what licks I'm going to play. So you start just playing stuff and bending it and you just do everything wrong until it starts turning right. And then that's how you figure out how to play with the Bender.
I have a tape of me the first night I had a bender, and I was in the garage at my mom and dad's house trying to figure out how not to break strings and get from here to here. And it's pretty funny. And just when I thought I'd gained on it a little bit, Porter Wagoner had a guy in his band named Buck Trent that played the electric banjo with twisters and keys. And it was, again, a steel guitar kind of way of thinking against the banjo. Buck Trent's one of my all-time heroes. When he passed away, his wife Jean brought his banjo, his electric banjo with all those tuners and pedals on it that was developed at Showbud Guitars, and left it at the house. And I had over Christmas to get to work on trying to figure out anything within a yard of Buck Trent's thinking. And again, it just goes back to, I wish I was a steel guitar player. That's what it all boils down to.
That's what it all comes down to. Really quickly, I want to wrangle through some artists that I think you're inspired by. I want to know where their inspiration comes into your playing. Someone like Bruce Springsteen. I've heard you say there's a lot, there's a little bit of Springsteen influence in what you do, right? Or maybe ethos. I feel like I've heard you say
this. I'll tell you my favorite thing. Yeah. Bruce. And if he hasn't heard this, I bet he would appreciate it. He had a song called I'm on Fire.
Yeah.
And when John R. Cash was old and we were making those American recording records, he'd call sometimes to come play guitar tomorrow. Yes, sir. I'll be there. So Johnny Cash was approaching singing I'm on Fire one day. And we started it off and he got about a verse into it and it crashed and we started over and he lifted off and crashed again. And under the authority of I Help Invent American Music, he pulled his pen out of his pocket and said, this song needs some work. And he took Bruce's lyrics and went into it. I went, that's beautiful. And I think Bruce would probably go, yeah, okay. That was Johnny Cash.
When you put out the album The Pilgrim, there were some reviews that called it like the Quadrophenia of country music. Were you influenced by The Who at all, or were you a fan of The Who?
Lightly.
Lightly.
I was a casual listener. I knew, you know, their hits that played on the radio. Later, I got into The Who really deeply and loved their recordings. But in the beginning, it was lightly. Probably by the time The Pilgrim was out, I had not gone deep into their catalog.
What's The Who albums that you really like, or The Who, Who music that you think is
really
great?
I Can See for Miles.
Yeah.
And My Generation. Just if they didn't do anything but those two songs right there, they could have walked off into the sunset with proud papas.
You say you discovered the Beatles pretty late in life, right? Relatively. Mm-hmm. What was it about the Beatles that really got you hooked when you finally discovered them?
The melodies, the words, the chord structure. It's so brilliant, so brilliant, so brilliant. It's funny, I listen to SiriusXM in my car a lot. I love listening to the Tom Petty channel. I make the rounds. But when you get around to the Beatles channel, everything just goes up in caliber and integrity. And then just it's one of those things. How did you guys do that? They probably don't even know how they did that, but it was so awesome.
Yeah. Marty Stewart, who is someone in country music that people need to know about that maybe not everyone knows about?
Coming up?
Maybe coming up. Could be a legend, though.
How about both? The Maddox Brothers and Rose.
Yeah.
They were known as the world's most colorful hillbilly band. Back in the Depression era, they traveled in a boxcar across country till they got to California because their mom had read dime novels about, you know, there's gold and then their hills. And so they needed a better way of life. They tried to give Rose away before they made the trip because they didn't think she was healthy enough to make it, little girl. But they got out there and went on the radio, and they were the first people to start wearing those fancy cowboy clothes. And it was like a herd of buffalo when they got out of, they traveled in three, four, or five matching Cadillacs at this time. And they should be in the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. They should be in the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because they helped turn the lights on. When me and the Superlatives started going to California, I called Merle Haggard at the end of the first trip we did that was really good, where a lot of people came to see us. And I said, I just want to thank you and Buck and those guys for giving us a road to ride on out here and teaching an audience and inspiring an audience how to treat a band. And he says, hey, you're welcome, but we all owe that debt of gratitude to the Maddox Brothers and Rose. So dig into the Maddox Brothers and Rose. Start with, you know, George's Playhouse Boogie and just keep going. New folks, I love Jake Worthington. He's an authentic country singer. A great writer, around here named Wyatt McCubbin. I love Wyatt's songs. They're real. She's not brand new anymore. I love that she was 15 minutes ago, but Sierra Farrell, I think, is one of the greatest talents that's ever walked through this town, especially these days. She's so real. Her talent is just off the chart.
Maurice Stewart, who is the most influential guitar player in the history of country music?
Oh. Well, we could debate that all day long. Some people would say Mother Maybelle Carter. Some people would say Chet Atkins. Some people would say Jerry Reed. I think you can only call it from your own perspective, from your own seat. And I gave you mine, but there's been some great ones. I love the fact that the superlative, we have this record called Space Junk, 20 instrumentals we wrote. I love the fact that my guys, I'm in a band with guys that can pick. That's so cool.
You've got the best band in country music.
I agree.
You? Isn't that a gift? Isn't that what you want?
It is a total gift.
How do you convince those guys to go out with you? Because you got to be the best too, right? What's
I didn't have anything to do with it. I was had lunch with Kenny Vaughn one day. I'd seen him on TV with Lucinda Williams on Austin City Limits. I liked him. He reminded me of Luther Perkins, just, you know, kind of a quirky character that played his tail off. And so we booked lunch. And by the time the ticket came, the bill came that day, I said, it was understood that I was going to find us a drummer and he was going to find us a bass player because he wasn't doing much. I wasn't doing anything. And let's put a band together. And when Harry Stinson agreed to be a part of it and we found a bass player, Brian Glenn was the first one, then Paul Martin, now Chris Scruggs. It's just one of those bands. It's a once-in-a-lifetime band. When it's all said and done, you can put them up there alongside the Buckaroos and the Tennessee Three and the Strangers and keep going. They're one of those bands.
You have this moment in your career that you've talked about a lot right after you put out The Pilgrim, which was such a great record and this critically acclaimed record, and the label basically dropped you after this record. And I think the turning point was you said, I'm not going to live and die by radio or the hits. I need to build a career. How do you do that? Because that's what you've done.
Did it slow the Grateful Dead down?
No.
Did it slow Billy Strings down? The bands I was with, Lester Flatt, hadn't had a hit since the Battle of Jed Clampett and Foggy Mountain Breakdown in the Bonnie and Clyde movie in 1967. Didn't matter. Everything he did was important. Bill Monroe hadn't had a hit in how many years? Didn't matter. He was Bill Monroe. Johnny Cash hadn't had a hit in over a decade till The Highwayman came along, and it was a long time after that before he had another one. But it did not matter because he was John R. Cash, and everything he did was scripture and verse and looked upon as such. And I thought, okay, if radio goes away, another hit will come around somewhere along the way. It always does if you stay after it. But in the meantime, let's do work that matters. At least to us.
What's the work that matters? Is it touring, playing in front of the fans, putting out the best music you can?
All the above.
All the above.
Telling the stories of the first pieces of our Magna Carta was, okay, let's go back into the woods and develop this band and bring out the stories of those people we're playing for. Turn them into stories, which turned into the Badlands record or the Soul's Chapel record. I love the fact that there's a lot of kids that play the guitar, look to the superlatives. One of the greatest compliments I ever had. Our theme song is...
Yeah.
Latingo Tango. Simple as a box of rocks. Any kid can play it. One of the greatest compliments I ever had, this fellow walked up one night to shake my hand, had his son with him. He said, my son and I had absolutely nothing in common till we started working on that song together, playing guitars. I went, done. That's called a hit to me.
That's what matters.
That's what matters.
Can you play us out with something? Is there anything you can play us out with? I'm putting you on the spot.
How about the rest
here?
Of that one?
Let's hear it.
What... You gotta announce me?
Marty Stewart of the Fabulous Superlatives here at the Fender Showroom. We are wrapping up here. Listen to this guy go. He doesn't know what he's doing on the guitar, he says, but somehow he doesn't need to. He's got it all figured out.
We're dedicating this to my pal Jonas Seifert.
There we go. Like right there, you go up the neck, you play a little lick. How do you know what that lick is?
I don't know. You think they would give you this guitar at the end of this, wouldn't you think?
Wouldn't that be something? Why would they give me anything? I don't. They
so
should
you
give
can
you
take
the
it
guitar.
Home and learn to play it. Then
I
you
need
can teach
to,
me
I
to
need
play
to,
it.
I need to play something. I love this guitar. The Silver Sparkle is so classic, cool. Right?
Zachary, thank you.
Marty, thanks
my
for
pleasure.
Taking the time. I really
thank
appreciate
you,
it. Is there anything that's been unsaid? Have we left anything out?
Mm-mm.
The new album, Space Junk, is out now. Instrumental album, 20 instrumental songs.
Original instrumental
yeah. songs. This, you recorded this in the Capitol Building, right? In
most
LA.
Most of it. Some of it in Nashville, but most of it at the Capitol Building. Yeah.
I saw you play it right here. It was
a good night.
You did. It sounded so good. It sounded like a record live. That's how good the band sounds.
That's it.
It was incredible.
Cool. Thank you, Zach.
Marty, thank you.
All the best.
We'll see you next time.
Got it.